Good evening, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom, where we examine the art and science of games. I'm still Josh Beiser, and we have a great cast for you this evening. Fortunately, James couldn't make it this time, but we have a new guest with us tonight to talk about his indie studio and his upcoming game. So, please welcome from Gray Alien Games, Jake Burkett.
Hi, Josh. Thanks very much for inviting me on your show.
No problem, Drake. It's great to have you on. For those of you listening to this cast, Jake was introduced to me via Cliff Harris, of course, the owner and lead designer of Positech Games. And it's always great to meet a new game developer and build our connections all throughout the industry. To get things going, how are things going with you, Jay? I know we are talking just at the tail end of February, and of course, GDC 2017 is slowly coming.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, actually, today I've spent quite a lot of time prepping for GDC, setting up meetings with developers. I want to show them my game, you see, and actually discuss design points. Yeah. And I've had to go out and buy all those kind of small toiletries you take on an aeroplane with you today. So,
Yes, that's always the very glamorous part of travel for everyone who goes around like that. So, as I was just saying, GDC is coming up. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to make it out this year. I'm hoping if 2017 is a good year for everything with Game Wisdom and growing, that I'll be able to make it out for 2018. So fingers crossed on that front. So is this, obviously this is not your first time going to GDC, right, Jay? I know we were just talking about this before the podcast, where you gave a presentation. Was that in GDC 2016?
Yeah, it was. I've been going for about 6-7 years, something like that. But last year I did a talk about being an indie developer for 11 years and not having a hit game, but managing to survive. And that's very popular. It's actually on YouTube. It's an official GDC video. Your listeners can look it up. It's I called the original one the No Hit Wonder, but they've called it something like 11 years and no hit game or something. But I'll send you a link to that.
Yep, definitely. And if we have time tonight to talk about it, I would love to talk and discuss more about surviving in the indie market for so long, because it's a very underdeveloped topic for a lot of industry, or a lot of the game industry. If not, then we will certainly hope try to get a follow-up with you, possibly after GDC.
That would be great.
So I guess to get the ball rolling then, Jake, since this is your first time on the cast, for people listening who may not have heard about you or your studio, could you talk a little bit about your background with the game industry?
Sure. I guess I've got probably a different background than many of the people you've spoken to so far. In that, I was a hobbyist for 21 years. I started coding on the Spectrum 48K, then the Commodore 64, then the Amiga. So I did all that as a hobby for many years. And then in 2005, I was actually programming a sort of arcade platform game, but I realized that at the time there wasn't a market for it and it would take forever to finish. So I switched over to making casual games. Now, when people hear the word casual games, they often think of mobile games, but this was before mobile. This was desktop games for PC and Mac that were sort of in the Match 3 genre, and I did a whole load of those. Then I made a solitaire game called Fairway Solitaire. You know, kept making games. I ended up working for a company called Big Fish Games in Canada for a couple of years. And then the last game we released in 2015 was called Regency Solitaire. And that was pretty popular. That one came out on Steam and it was kind of our first game that got any kind of recognition in the mainstream press, because the mainstream press doesn't normally cover casual games. And now I'm working on Shadowhand, which is an RPG card game with a sort of turn-based solitaire mechanic that's never been done before. And that's the one that's being published by Cliff Harris of Positech Games. So, yeah, that's kind of me in a nutshell.
All right. And glad you mentioned Regency Solitaire, Jay, because like you said, that was like the first one that I really heard. And when I listened to my friends, like that was one of the games I kind of like came up during like the casual market discussion. And sometimes it's really interesting how some of these games will sort of pique the consumer interest like that.
Hmm. Well, the thing with Regency Solitaire is it was squarely aimed at the casual market. Mm-hmm. The game idea was my wife's idea. She works with me on the design and writing. And she suggested that a card game set in the Regency period would be a really good combination because cards were very popular. And just for your listeners who may not know, the Regency time period in England was, well, our game set in 1812. It was before Victorian times, okay? And it was when King George III was rather ill and his son, who ended up being King George IV, he was the Prince Regent. And it's a popular time period for romance novels in the vein of sort of Jane Austen and so on. So that was a casual game aimed at the casual market. And in fact, it's made most of its money in the casual market. But we thought we'd try it on Steam just to see what would happen. And it's only really when you get a game on Steam that the press even begins to take notice. It's almost like a validator. And then it did get picked up in quite a few outlets, either by people who genuinely loved it or by people who were sort of playing it and couldn't believe that they found found it fun. You know, they were thinking, this is not my type of game. Bro gamers, I might call them, you know, who were going, well, actually, this is more fun than I expected. So that was pretty interesting.
Yeah. And about the casual market, I mean, we could easily have an entire podcast talking about just that particular area of the game industry. And you mentioned a few seconds ago, Jake, about Big Fish Games, and they were for a time, for those of you listening to this cast, they were one of like the bigger casual game developers up there with PopCap Games and Artifex Mundi at the time, or what Artifex is still going on. Is Big Fish still making games at the moment? Because I haven't heard too much out of them, at least among my circles.
Well, the thing with Big Fish is they actually made most of their money, I mean, 99% of their money from distributing games. Mm-hmm. So they would release a game a day, and some of their customers thought it was their own games. Well, of course it wasn't. No one can make a game a day, but they were releasing games by developers like myself. But they did have an internal catalog, as you know, correctly identified, and they did, you know, occasionally release games. But I think a while ago they switched focus to mobile. So you won't see many of their games on desktop these days. I could be wrong about that, but I think it's mostly mobile. They are still going, and they are probably still the biggest desktop casual game vendor, and they do very well on mobile. But I think that market on desktop is declining, and that's one of the reasons I've decided to make Shadowhand a bit more the sort of theme and style and depth that a Steam audience would enjoy, because we're trying to sort of move away from casual as it sort of slowly collapses like a dying star.
Yeah. And it's kind of interesting about that, because as we were just saying, like Big Fish and PopCap for the better part of the last decade were very recognizable among the casual game front. I mean, from my own experience, I loved playing games like Bookworm. Let me see. Of course, Plants vs. Zombies is another one. And and let's not forget Peggle from PopCap.
Absolutely. Those three games are excellent, excellent games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they were one of those very rare, quote-unquote, casual games that managed to, like, break into the mainstream. Like, this wasn't a case of people, you know, sneering at them or, as you said, the quote-unquote bro gamers dismissing them as, you know, the casual games for your mom or your grandmother. They got incredibly popular. And speaking about GDC, I always love to bring this up. I attended, I think it was the 2011 talk by Plants vs. Zombies designer George Tan, who talked about how he designed Plants vs. Zombies to be accessible to even his mother, who's never played a video game. And that was just a fascinating talk, and it is just an amazing game to look at.
Yeah, it is a great game, and I think I've seen the same talk, actually. Actually, the interesting thing is when that game came out on, I saw it on Big Fish Games, it did okay, but it wasn't sort of a top 10 game on Big Fish Games, so it didn't have quite the impact within the casual market, and then they put it in the sort of on Steam and on consoles and so on, and mobile, of course, and it did have a greater impact there. So already that was a sort of crossover game in a way for them. Yeah.
Yep, definitely. And I guess this takes me to a very interesting question for you, Jake. As we've said, when it comes to the term casual, it can mean different things depending upon who you're talking to. There are people who, like we just said, they will dismiss it. As you were just saying, the casual market has certainly moved in and out from PC to mobile and where it's at today. So my question for you, I actually asked this of when I spoke to RFX Mundi in a written interview, I think it was 2 years ago. The question is, when you hear the term casual, what do you think that represents?
Okay. I mean, it's a good question. For me, it's always meant downloadable desktop games, which ended up kind of being within certain genres, like Match 3, Hidden Object, Time Management, Puzzle Games, Word Games, and so on. However, even back in the day, if you said casual to some people, they actually thought you meant flash games. Mm-hmm. Okay, so flash games you could play with just a mouse, right? Yes. Which I guess is casual. And only recently, well, I say recently, in my time scales, it's recently 5-6 years or whatever, casual has come to mean mobile games. Mm-hmm. Because that's maybe where most people are playing them now. Mm-hmm. So I'm aware of all of those three connotations. And I've seen games labeled as casual, especially when there are flash games, that weren't casual in their content. They may have been actually quite violent or whatever, and maybe quite deep in some aspects, but just because they were played with a mouse and they were in flash, people called them casual. So it's kind of interesting how the usage has changed and how people's perception of it changed. Whenever I say casual now, people always assume mobile.
Yeah.
And I have to kind of clarify when I say that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I remember over the last decade, of course, the Flash era, Shockwave.com, and then, of course, moving on to PopCap and Big Fish. And it really is interesting about how things have really transformed. And as you just said, Jake, when it comes to the mobile scene, the casual market has been its bread and butter now for, what is it, like 4 or 5 years, maybe even a little bit more than that.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking there's one thing we missed out in casual is a lot of the casual developers actually started moving over to Facebook around 2009, 2010. Yeah. Remember, the iPhone only got really good in sort of 2008, the end of. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people went to Facebook first because of Farmville making a fortune and so on. And in fact, we were involved in making a Facebook game at Big Fish Games. Mm-hmm. But then it became very hard for smaller developers to succeed on Facebook because of the huge budgets required to advertise and what they call acquire and retain customers. Mm-hmm. So a lot of those developers and the market generally shifted over to mobile. So Facebook was like a stepping stone, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And another part of, I guess, that casual stigma, of course, has been, as you were just saying, Jacob, in terms of its genres. When we talk, of course, about the last decade, as you said, it was about the Hidden Object, the Match 3, and the time management games. And one of the things that when it comes to people who sneer at the casual games, they consider them to be, you know, very simplistic, bare bones, you know, something that's going to give you maybe 2 minutes of entertainment, and then you delete and you move on to something else. But I'm sure, as someone who has designed a variety of casual games, that there is depth to it. There is work that goes into making these games as appealing as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is a common misconception. Perhaps mobile hasn't helped there, because of course, when a new platform comes along, often the new games on it are actually simplified versions. So when the first Match 3s and so on were coming out on mobile, the PC counterparts were actually considerably more advanced. So if you think about Bejeweled, the original Bejeweled, it was just an 8x8 grid, and you just played the levels over and over. And then gradually games introduced different shape levels, different mechanics, bombs, explosions, meta games where you purchase power-ups over time, stories. And I've done all of those in my Match 3 games. My last Match 3 was called Spooky Bonus, and that was very, very popular in the casual market, a Halloween-themed one where you decorate your house, and all of the decorations create power-ups that you can use in the game. And so there's a huge amount of depth you can add in terms of piling on these mechanics and different strategies, and you can make them very hard. So a lot of casual gamers are actually quite hardcore in their approach to the quantity of games they buy, the amount of hours they game per week, and the level of challenge they expect from the game. Like, they may start easily, but they ramp up in difficulty. So they should never be dismissed as you know, some kind of 2-minute throwaway game. But I think that idea has come from mobile. But, yeah. You know, people play games for hours on mobile these days as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, mm-hmm, definitely. And going back to when I looked at RFX Mundi, for instance, they are very much like go like that elevator route in terms of their casual games. They have a lot of achievements. There's different difficulty levels. And, of course, they're just very appealing to a wide berth in terms of an audience. Now, mm-hmm. I guess here's a question for you, Jake. There is a common perception when it comes to talking about casual games that they are mainly for women, that, you know, mm-hmm. the female casual market, that kind of thing. From your own experience, is that preconception true, or has it really expanded to more demographics over the last few years?
Actually, it is true. At least it was true based upon some surveys that I've seen done. So Big Fish Games and I think some other people, maybe Casual Connect, there's a conference. I don't know if they were involved. There's a magazine they have. They did survey these audiences and found that in some cases, yeah, maybe as much as 80% of the customers were women. Those women were often aged 30 until well into retirement, you know. And they did tend to favor certain genres of games, you know, which casual games were serving up to them. But there were definitely male gamers in there and people of different ages, which did not fit that demographic, of course. I mean, I think part of the problem is that these games are actually really great games. I've played some fantastic hidden object games, some great time management games that are very challenging. A lot of clicking, a lot of working out strategies. It's just that people are missing out by not playing them. But if you're into good games, you like a good game if it's on mobile, if it's on PC, if it's on console and handheld, if it's a board game, a card game. If you like a good game, you know, you'll find it and you'll play it. But so I don't think it is a misconception. I think it is true. A lot of the casual gamers were and are women. And that's fine. You know, Regency Solitaire was a romantic card game, and we believe that most of our customers, based on the feedback, were women, but plenty of men enjoyed it too. I mean, I like costume drama TV shows. I watch them with my wife, and that's why we enjoyed making the game.
Definitely. And as you just said, Jake, if the game is good enough, it can break out of its chosen demographic, as we've seen with all manner of titles when they achieve that level of critical success.
Yeah, and we're hoping that's what we would do with Shadowhand, our current game, where we've taken the solitaire aspect but turned it into turn-based combat and layered on a whole RPG system that you'd expect in a game like Darkest Dungeon or something like that. And we're hoping that that will enable us to get a male and female audience and break out of the casual crowd, especially as we're selling only on Steam, not the casual portals at all.
Yep, definitely. And that actually takes me to, I guess, two big questions I want to ask you about, Jake. And I guess we'll start with the casual one. As you said a few minutes ago, the perception and market for casual games has certainly shifted over the last few years. As we've said, obviously, with the rise of mobile, and so are mobile becoming the brand for, or branding casual games along that front. And it seems as if, as we've been seeing, that there's more discussions about the state or stability of mobile games. So I guess my question for you is, what do you make of, I guess, the state of casual games when it comes to mobile in, I guess, today's market?
Well, I'm probably slightly out of the loop because I don't really play them myself on the phone. I just find them too small and fiddly. I know they're better to play on tablets. But one of the things which obviously has occurred is that casual games have gone down the free-to-play route. And when I was making casual games for desktop, what would happen is you would get a one-hour demo to play, and then you would have to buy the game. A bit like the old shareware model. I mean, Doom was sold on the same model. And I was okay with that. People get to try it. If they like it, they get to buy it. With free-to-play, of course, you want them to get hooked in immediately, and then you sort of use various psychological tricks on them to convince them at some point to spend the money. And 99% of people spend no money, but 1% of people want a little part of their brain it, you know, falls for the tricks, or maybe consciously or subconsciously, and then they spend the money. And I sort of found, as I researched that quite a lot, I sort of found it slightly distasteful. And I also believe it can limit the design of games in certain ways. So you're always trying to sort of hook them in and make them feel sort of they need to spend money. I do believe that limits certain types of games. Yeah. I'm sure many free-to-play game designers would disagree with me and say, you know, not at all, it's the future of gaming and so on. Mm-hmm. It's not personally for me, and it's not personally the type of game I want to make. I want to make the type of game you pay for and love playing all the way through, like watching a great movie or reading a great book.
Yep, definitely. And I'm actually making a post as we're talking today, or for those of you listening to this cast, will probably be a week or so, talking about that kind of one of the forms of monetization, the pay or wait or energy mechanics, mm-hmm. and how for a lot of those games, it just really becomes an intrusive form, like interfering with the game development. And that, I think, is a really interesting point about kind of the casual or free-to-play crowd versus like the core, or as you said, Jake, the Steam audience. Mm. And for like people like myself in the core audience, we prefer, you know, the one-time purchase. We don't want to be hit by every minute an ad, or every 2 minutes, you know, pop up saying, if you want to go further, you know, throw us a dollar or 50 mm-hmm. cents. And that kind of perception is a really big deal. When we see games make that transition from mobile to computer or computer to mobile, as we've been seeing over the last few years.
Yeah, big time. I mean, I feel the same. And in fact, when we sold Regency Solitaire on Steam, we were mm-hmm. very careful to put in the text, this is not a mobile game. Mm-hmm. Because many people see a casual game and automatically assume it's a mobile game and therefore free or costs $1 or something. Now, Regency Solitaire hasn't come out on mobile. It might do in the future, but it hasn't at the moment. And we wanted to clear that perception up right from the start mm-hmm. that they knew they were getting a quality PC game.
Yeah. And that's definitely one of the bigger challenges. As you said a few minutes ago, the fact that casual has been sort of engulfed by the mobile market means that it's a lot harder for your game to stand out. And mm-hmm. I'm curious, I know neither of us probably have this information, but I'm curious about how Artifex Mundi is doing these days. Again, they are one of the premier casual game developers with their Hidden Object games, and they've been putting more and more of them up on Steam over the last few years. Mm. I'm curious how the Steam audience is looking at those titles.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because I was thinking about that, I think, just today. I was wondering how, but I'll tell you why, because there are, I do know a few developers who've made casual Hidden Object games, and those developers, some of them have closed their studios because mm-hmm. what happened is the quality bar kept rising mm-hmm. and so they had to spend a lot more money on each game, whereas the customer base was decreasing because they were fleeing desktop and going to mobile. And obviously Artifex Mundi was doing that as well. Mm-hmm. And one has to wonder. I do know that, to be honest, most casual games do not do very well on Steam. I've already told you that Regency Solitaire hasn't done as well on Steam as on the casual portals. So it definitely can't, it's not a sort of strategy to make a casual game for Steam. It's just an extra bonus portal. But I do not know how they're doing. And I would think they would have probably had to embrace mobile and do very well on mobile in order to survive. But that's not a route I want to go down. I actually prefer to distance myself from mobile.
Yeah. And that's interesting that you just said that, Jake, about how Regency Solitaire did better among the casual game sites as opposed to Steam. Because mm-hmm. one of the big discussions we've been having over the last few weeks, of course, has been the coming changes to Steam with Steam Direct. And Valve's essentially attempt to filter out the shovelware or the bomb of the bin games that have sort of risen up and has hurt the quality line when it comes to Steam. And the point that I want to get to is that one of the things that has been talked about, especially over the last decade, has been how Steam has become, you know, the monolithic top gorilla or king of the hill. Like, if you want your game to sell, the general consensus is you get on Steam or your game's not going to sell. And And as you were just saying, it's kind of interesting the fact that Resident Solitaire did better off of Steam, as pretty much like you, the general opinion would have been that being on Steam would have been, you know, this huge attraction to your title.
Yeah, you'd think so. But as I said, we did deliberately target the casual mm-hmm. market, and we think it was almost the perfect game for the casual market. Mm-hmm. And so it did well there. It's done okay on Steam in the long run. But if we had only shipped on Steam, we'd have gone out of business.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the reality of it. You know, there are fans, but it just isn't a good match for the Steam audience. You know, it hasn't got a dark theme. You know, it looks like a casual game, and so on. So it's just not really kind of what Steam customers are looking for. That, I think that's one of the biggest challenges indies face is, mm-hmm. are you making the game, you know, some game you've picked out of a hat that you want to make, or have you examined the market you're attempting to sell on, whether it's console, Steam or whatever, mm-hmm. and are you targeting your game effectively at that market from the very first idea all the way through? Mm-hmm. And Steam wasn't that, and we knew it wasn't, but it's a bonus money for us for Regency. Yeah. But Shadowhand, yes, we're laser focused on the Steam audience.
Mm-hmm. And I definitely want to talk more about Shadowhand for the cast. One other question that I want to ask you about, Jake, and this goes back to kind of the concepts of casual design. As we've been talking over the last 30 minutes, that when it comes to making that casual game, it does require you to, I guess, specify the kind of market and the kind of consumers you're aiming for. And as we said a few minutes ago, that for a lot of casual fans, it's aimed at the quote-unquote non-gamers or women who are interested in video games, as we were just saying. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that we've been talking about is the fact that there is a lot of work that goes into making a good casual game.
So my
question for you, Jake, is, as someone who's designed these casual games and who's followed them, what elements do you think, or what are like some of the more underappreciated or understated elements that make a good casual game versus the ones that just pop up, you know, like your dime a dozen games that quickly appear and disappear, like on the iOS store?
Sure. Okay. So within it, the casual desktop market, even, you know, you've got mm-hmm. clearly some games that are higher quality in every aspect than other games that are just sort of definitely banged out very cheaply, mm-hmm. either by inexperienced developers or developers trying to do it on the cheap, you know, and going for quantity rather than quality. So one of the things is obviously to pick a good theme which will resonate with the audience. Mm-hmm. And we knew that Regency Solitaire, you know, the Regency theme would resonate with the casual audience. Whereas if you make, say, a sci-fi game, that mm-hmm. never seems to go down well with a casual audience. They're just not really interested. Another big mistake I think actually some casual developers make is to assume that because the audience is women or of a certain age, that they don't want any depth or challenge, and therefore they make a sort of boring game with no challenge, no depth, you know, no strategy. Mm-hmm. That's a very big mistake. These are, you know, many of these women are very intelligent gamers who want a really good, solid experience. They mm-hmm. just don't want to play. They just don't want to play Call of Duty, right?
Yeah.
Which, you know, one could actually argue is a mindless experience, mm-hmm. depending on how you decide to play it. Mm-hmm. So really, one of the key things is about designing a game which immediately grabs you and is fun and easy to get into, but must introduce new mechanics, new layers and strategies mm-hmm. really throughout the entire game to hold that person's interest and to keep them rewarded. And you have to spend a lot of time making sure things like the sound effects aren't annoying and that there's visual feedback which is rewarding to the player, and you have to have a really good, decent tutorial that isn't annoying, and in fact that can be switched off. Let's say mm-hmm. you're making a match three game, there's a good chance that 9 out of 10 of your players have played one before. So if you hold their hand and sort of patronize them through a match three tutorial, you're going to annoy them.
Yeah.
So you need to be able to make sure that you can just sort of either switch that off or ignore it, and it won't get in the way of your play. So there are many, many sort of components, but a lot of the things that make a good casual game still apply to making a good indie game or any game. You know, user feedback, testing, just the sort of detail you put into all of the sort of elements, the UI, the sound, the interactivity, the smoothness. All my games run at 60 frames per second, for example. You might think that's overkill for a casual game, but it looks great when the special effects fly around and the shapes move. And lower frame rates can make a game feel, you know, stodgy. And so there are so many details I tune in my game, you know, the rate at which things move or drop or bang into each other. So many things, really. Putting a sine wave when the dialogues fly on instead of just flying them on linearly. Lots of tiny tweaks. Anyway, I could go on for hours about this topic, but hopefully there's some ideas in there.
Yeah. And again, it's one of those things that it seems very understated when we talk about game development. As you said, when a lot of people look at video games in terms of those that break down, they tend to focus on the big bombastic titles, your Call of Duties, your Battlefield, Dark Souls, etc. But when we take a look at games such as the titles from Artifex Mundi, Regency Solitaire, and of course Plants vs. Zombies, Peggle, etc., there are a lot of little details that go into making these games as appealing as possible. From the 2011 GDC talk about Plants vs. Zombies, I remember George said he spent a lot of time simply coming up with how to position the flower cards on the UI at the top of the screen. Now, even those little details, such as what appears first, can mean a huge difference towards someone understanding how your game works.
Yeah, absolutely. And with Regency Solitaire, we wanted to make the user interface feel like a finely crafted piece of jewelry. And so my wife actually went around the Victoria and Albert Museum, and we also went around another museum in Bath here. And we took photographs of Georgian jewelry and then tried to incorporate sort of the various elements and feel into our UI. So the UI itself was themed towards the genre and time period of the game, not just some kind of white or gray boxes sitting over some game, which is, I guess, what a lot of AAA games do these days. They sort of minimize it almost. Yeah. We wanted to be part of the whole. So it is very, very important, in my opinion, to get that stuff right.
Now, before we move on to talk more about your titles and Shadowhand, there's one question I want to ask you about, Jake. And this will probably, if we do have hopefully we have a second cast to talk more about being an indie developer, this will probably come up then. But I figure it is important to talk about this now. As we said a few minutes ago, Steam Direct is currently one of like, the bigger news pieces out of Steam and Valve over the last few weeks, and I'm sure things will open up or will become more detailed as we get further into 2017 and for its spring 2017 launch. And one of the questions I've been asking the developers that we've been talking to over the last few weeks has been their thoughts on it. So if you wouldn't mind, Jake, especially as someone who has been in the indie market for so long, what do you think about the changes that Valve has planned?
Well, it's a tricky subject because I swing between two camps, really. Okay. So as I was a hobbyist for 20 odd years, I totally understand why anyone as a hobbyist or a part-time or new indie dev would want to get their game on Steam. They view it as, you know, a route to riches. Yes. That's false in most cases, but they want to have that hope and they want to get the game out there and they want to get it in front of people. So in the sort of, I would say, hippie socialist side of me, I'm thinking, whoa, you know, this is bad. Anyone should be able to get on there. But of course, we know what happens in similar markets like the Apple Store, right? Or Android. You know, they get very crowded very quickly. It becomes harder to perhaps find what you're looking for. There's a lot more competition. Yes. So as the sort of business person who is running a full-time indie studio, of course, I would much rather be in some kind of elite group which was selected to go on Steam, perhaps at a high cost, and others were therefore excluded. That doesn't sound very nice, of course, and many people you know, dislike that sort of viewpoint, but I do have to survive, and it's extremely hard to survive. Yeah. And if I believe that I can get better sort of storefront coverage and make more sales for my games by paying a fee, that could be to my advantage. Of course, there are many arguments which say these other games that are perhaps not selling very well and are quote cluttering up the store, well, they're not competing with you anyway, because they're not taking your money away. Mm-hmm. Though others would say they're taking away their customers' eyeballs.
Yes.
And it also, of course, it's down to the customer perception of the store. Do you want the store to be a curated store and know that everything mm-hmm. on there is within a certain quality bar, or not? You know, do you feel like you're taking a lucky dip mm-hmm. when you buy something? So there are all those things to factor in, but you could say, hey, you can pay a fee and still put a bad quality game on there. So there's almost a counter argument for mm-hmm. every pro argument. Yeah. I'm going to have to reserve judgment and see what happens. I do think there are still, I would remind people that if you do want to be a hobbyist and make a game and put it on the internet, you can still put the game on your own website. Yeah. That's what I did. That's what Cliff did. You can still put it on itch.io mm-hmm. and many other sites. And maybe you can put it on Steam if you can find a publisher or find some way to pay the fee. Because if you're serious about making a living from games, you know, you would just need to factor that into your budget, like a PC or some art or mm-hmm. or getting your accounts done or whatever. So I don't know. I swing from both. Mm-hmm. Whatever I say is probably going to offend somebody.
Yeah, that's always how it works. Yeah, and it last time or it's always tricky because we record these casts and they don't go up like anywhere when they get posted. But when I spoke with Cliff Harris, again from Podset Games, we talked about Steam Direct. And he's very much on the side that he wants Steam to be like this curated place. It's supposed to be for the, you know, the best of the best. And if that mm-hmm. means having a fee or having, you know, some kind of bouncer at the door kind of thing to make sure that what you find there are going to be the best games, he is for it. And I think I tend to agree with him, especially as we've seen Steam open up, and it has become a lot harder to find great games on there. What earlier in the cast, you were talking about how a lot of people will immediately sneer at a casual tag if it's listed on Steam. And I'm sure one of the things that hasn't helped has been the number, and I mean vast number, of like the clicker games and a lot of the poor ports of mobile games that have flooded the Steam side as well. Now, of course, there are some great games in that bunch, but as we've said, it's very hard to pick out the diamonds from everything else.
Mm, for sure. I mean, there's also some bad Greenlight games mm-hmm. on there that aren't casual yes. at all, or publisher back catalogs of games which maybe are sort of beyond their sell by date, if you know what I mean, and yeah. so look dated. Or so there are many different games on there. As I say, it's a tricky issue because the pure capitalist version of me is like, yes, put the fee as high as possible. Mm-hmm. Let me be part of that group so that I can continue yeah. making games for as many years as possible and support my family mm-hmm. and that the customers will know what they're getting is hopefully of some level of commercial standard at least. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean it's good fun or good quality. We know that AAA games cost millions and can be yes. bad. So, but, you know, that, and I think there are other places for people to sell games. But a lot of people are very much against gated communities yeah. as such. So mm-hmm. it's a tough issue. I know that that's the way Cliff thinks for sure. More power to him. But yeah.
mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm sure, as I said, this is still end of February as we're talking about this. And I am very sure that more details will be coming out before this goes into effect. Mm. And there is always a possibility that Valve will change things up or alter their original statement. Mm. I mean, they did the same thing with the whole paid mod disaster from, I think that was 2015, I want to say. Now, I guess my...
Sorry, I have another comment on that, sure. Josh, actually. It suddenly occurred to me that the thing with the casual portals which sell my games is what there were at one point, Big Fish Games were getting something like 15 game submissions per day. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they only put one game out per day on their website. Mm-hmm. So they had a huge team there processing those games to check out whether they're any good. Mm-hmm. And, well, you had a 1 in 15 chance of making it through, right? Mm-hmm. And so... early on, some of portals actually rejected some of my games and others took them. Later on, they maybe changed and maybe took my games. But the casual portals always were curating and you had mm-hmm. to make a game good enough to get on there. Yeah. So you had to be serious commercially to do that. And if you were making games for fun or a hobby, you just wouldn't get on there. You'd have to put them on your website or download.com or mm-hmm. whatever other thing. So Steam doing this new system is only kind of like that.
Yeah.
Really, except you pay a fee, but you get it back. But it's the same kind of system. Mm-hmm. Not everything gets on there. There is a gate, and I've been used to that for years.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, as I was just saying, I think my final question, again, we could spend another 40, 50 minutes talking about this. And when we do have our discussion about being in the indie space, this will probably come up then. But to wrap up talking about for right now, I just want to get your thoughts on the supposed or the proposed fee for Steam Direct. As for those of you who missed the news, Valve is considering having the fee, as we just said, it's going to be recuperable, but they're thinking between either $100 or a max of $5,000. And my question for you, Jake, is what do you think would be a fair fee for Steam? Mm. Do you think it would be on the lower end, the higher end, the middle, or somewhere anywhere else?
Okay, so one thing I think they said in their announcement about that was these were the fees mentioned to them by developers. Mm-hmm. So it didn't mean that they were necessarily considering it. If I was a lawyer, you know, I would say they were saying,
yeah,
this is what developers said to them. So they could pick anything. They could pick 50,000 or five, you know. Mm-hmm. Another thing to consider is there was always a certain fee anyway to get on Greenlight. And one of my games sat on there for a year. It's a game that sold 50,000 copies in the casual market, mm-hmm. but it was almost impossible to get through Greenlight. And I absolutely would have easily paid $100 to get it on Steam immediately instead of having to go through the whole rigmarole of Greenlight and have all these people, you know, crappy publishers trying to contact me to get my game in Greenlight bundles and so on. So I absolutely would have paid more than $100 personally. The other aspect is a lot of people are worried that people in countries with a different economy, different currency valuation may find it hard to pay the fee. But I do believe Valve will adjust that fee according to your country of origin. I can't see that they wouldn't do that. I think that's an important point. So in a way, yes, the capitalist side of me would like that fee to be reasonably high, because I don't think $100 has deterred people from getting on the apps, the iOS App Store or Greenlight. It's not high enough. So it may have to be in the sort of $1,000 plus range, mm-hmm. I would think personally. Yeah. So I am for a higher fee, because I think it's just part of your cost of doing business and making mm-hmm. a game. And I think that what will happen is if people can't pay that, but they've got a good game, there will be people that will help them if they recognize it's a good game, publishers or friends mm-hmm. or whatever, and they'll make an effort. But it should really help cut out games mm-hmm. that perhaps are free games that people just want to get on there, or perhaps, you know, just some kind of attempt to just spam the store with something for a joke or whatever. So mm-hmm. I think that will help. It's tricky. That's going to annoy a lot of people, what I said, but there you go. I would be fine with $1,000 plus, but I'm an established developer trying to survive. So,
mm-hmm. yeah, I think for me, I was thinking like in the $500 to $1,000 range myself. Sure. I think for like people who say like $5,000, I think that may be a little overkill. I think when I spoke with Cliff, I think he was of the opinion that the higher the better. But again, we are just talking hypotheticals at the moment. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, Valve is going to be the one who's going to attach that sticker price.
Yeah, and something else that has been mentioned is that it isn't necessarily in Valve's interest to block any games because the iOS App Store doesn't really block anything, not really. There are certain quality standards they have mm-hmm. for swearing or offensive material, and Amazon doesn't block anything, and probably Valve doesn't want to block anything. They just want to fix their discoverability mechanisms so that you can find whatever game you want. But they still want to welcome on all games because more games in theory equals more money. Mm-hmm. So what they're trying to do here is sort of keep their customers under the impression that they have got some kind of quality control and keep developers happy, and balance that against making as much money as possible, I guess. You know, I don't know their internal motivations, but I'm speculating.
Yeah. All right, so with that, I think we'll move into probably the final part for the cast. And again, there's a lot we can talk about, but I want to try to keep things somewhat focused, or we'll be here till for another hour or two. And
sure.
I know there's a 5-hour time difference between us right now.
Yeah, it's close to my dinner. And also, I think Cliff probably wants to play Battlefield 1, so... I might have to go and do that with him soon. I know I've made casual games, but you know, I've beaten Dark Souls 2. I've played nice. All the RPGs through the years. I love arcade games. Mm-hmm. I love all games. If they're good, I love them. So
awesome. All right. So with that, I want to talk more about your recent game, what you're working on right now with Shadowhand. And I also have a bit of a question for you, like going back to with Regency Solitaire. Now, obviously, when someone hears the word solitaire, they're thinking the timeless time waster game that we see on every computer since the old days. My question for you, Jake, from a design standpoint, how did you go about, I guess, elevating it to the point that it can stand as a mechanic in one of your titles?
Okay, well, the interesting thing about Solitaire is it's not really a single game. There are many different ways it can be played. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the classic Windows 3.1 or Windows 95 version of Solitaire, you know, you've got to pile up the cards on these four piles. The game that I programmed as a contractor for Big Fish Games back in 2007, Fairway Solitaire, that game used a type of mechanic called Golf Solitaire. Mm-hmm. Where you have a numbered card at the bottom, say a 5, and therefore on the tableau you can either click a card higher or lower, so a 4 or a 6, and then you can make chains of cards. And it leads to a sort of faster, more fun gameplay, and in fact a sort of thing where you can reward players for getting a large chain of cards. And Fairway Solitaire was very, very successful in the casual space, and many games cloned it afterwards. And Regency Solitaire was kind of like, how many years later, 7-8 years later, I sort of decided to use that same mechanic, but with some other ideas in there and the metagame and the story. And it leads itself well. One of the key things is it lends itself well to different layouts. So you can have different level layouts with maybe lots of piles or piles with many cards in. And then I added things like locks and keys, or locks which would only unlock when you got a certain number of royal cards. And I added power-ups to help you clear the card that charge up over time. So all of these extra mechanics that you couldn't do with a real deck of card, but you can do with a computer, they add a lot more interest and longevity to the game. And then we took that to a new level with Shadowhand by saying, what if instead of in turn-based combat, instead of rolling a die or dice, you get a run of cards to charge up your weapons, and a good run is effectively a critical hit and a bad run is effectively a miss. And that's the core idea behind the Shadowhand's dueling stages.
Mm-hmm. And that's very interesting in terms of designing it. And I don't think we've been talking about Shadowhand over the last 50 minutes or so, but just to sort of, I guess, take us into the section. For people listening to this cast who are now just hearing about it, what is Shadowhand like for someone like brand new listening to this cast?
Okay, so it's a prequel to Regency Solitaire. So it's set in 1770 England, and it's about a young woman who is an aristocrat in the daytime, but she's a highwaywoman at night. Mm-hmm. She's not actually an evil highwaywoman, more like a sort of Robin Hood figure. She's out to sort of correct wrongs, because this was a sort of lawless time in England, okay, with corrupt judges, maybe it's the same as now, corrupt judges running the country and so on. And so she has to sort of travel around the sort of dark English countryside, fighting various foes with a variety of weapons, and collecting gear and loot and different outfits to power herself up. And along the way, you know, there's a story that's being told as well. What's different, as I say, is that Solitaire's never been used in this sort of turn-based combat style, and it's pretty addictive and fun. It's an interesting take on solitaire and turn-based combat that we think people are going to enjoy a lot. It's also got really nice artwork, and everything in it's been researched by my wife to be historically accurate in terms of the costumes, the items we're using, the weapons, and the language, locations. You know, the whole thing isn't just sort of a complete flight of fancy. We are history buffs, and so we've spent a lot of time watching shows, researching things, visiting locations, taking photos and so on to give it that air of authenticity. So that's what Shadowhand is. I think it's going to be a very exciting RPG card game is the best way we can describe it, but it really is something new, and we hope it will appeal to card game fans and RPG fans, and people will just give it a shot. Mm-hmm. The main thing is because Regency was a romantic card game that put off a certain segment of players who, when they ended up playing it, some of them were like, well, they really like the mechanic, but they don't like the theme. So we're hoping that this theme will help bring those players to the game. Mm-hmm. and you know, get them addicted and hooked into the mechanic and the metagame. And with any luck, it will succeed and we can make another one.
Yeah, and I'm looking at your site now. It looks very fascinating. Again, combining like this kind of card-based system with the RPG side of things. So I guess my question for you is, in terms of, I guess, like the base mechanics of Shadowhand, is this more like akin to a CCG where your gear that you wear or the items you put on are kind of like your quote-unquote deck? Or is it more like along lines of each piece of gear is a card and then that card does something kind of thing?
I think more like the second, what you said, because early on when we did the design, we knew we wanted the cards to drive the combat. Mm-hmm. And we were actually just going to have the character have standard inventory items like you'd get in an RPG, you know, mm-hmm. weapons or whatever. And then we said, well, actually, we may as well show those weapons and outfit items on a card. So mm-hmm. it's thematically consistent. So you do collect stuff on cards, which you then put on your character. You could view it as a deck, but you're not really using that deck in the game. Mm-hmm. It's just your equipment. However, having said all that, there are a few cards that you do select in like a mini deck, because you have special abilities you can take into the levels with you. There are three ability cards out of a larger selection. Mm-hmm. A bit like in Plants vs. Zombies, where you choose mm-hmm. The cards you wish to take into the level with you, and there's a limited amount of slots to do that, right? Mm-hmm. And later on, you end up with more cards than slots. So you do that in our game with A, your weapons, B, your consumables, which means, I don't mean free-to-play consumables, I mean things like potions and bombs, okay? So you can chuck things and take things, plus your abilities. So there is some aspect of deck building, but mostly it's about playing this sort of solitaire mechanic, getting a good run of cards to charge up your weapons to attack the enemy AI, and then the enemy does the same back at you, and the various strategies you can do to prevent them getting a good run or giving yourself a better run and so on.
Interesting. And as you said, Jake, it's definitely not something we see all too often, this kind of blending of genres, like with the solitaire and the RPG side of things. And I was trying, while you were describing it, I was trying to think of games that went with combining like either a puzzle or a common game mechanic with something that's more RPG based, and mm-hmm. like a few things that came to my mind was stuff like the recent like Puzzle Quest games that combine match 3 with an RPG progression. Yep. And there was this one game that it's like on the tip of my tongue, I can't remember the name of it. I remember it was like a dice or card based game. I think it was maybe solitaire or some kind of like number based game that came out on Steam, but I cannot remember this name. It is on my Steam list, but I have over 1,000 games on Steam, so if I start looking at it now, we'll be here for a good 20 minutes of me searching for it.
Well, there's a recent game called Solitarica, which actually does use a golf themed solitaire game, sorry, golf mechanic it's called, to actually fight an enemy. So it in a way is using a similar idea to us. In fact, when I saw their game, because we came up with our idea quite a while ago, I did email them and did a friendly sort of, hey guys, we're doing the same kind of idea in our game, just so you know, so that when we come out with ours, there's no sort of, hey, you nicked our idea, because some people can be precious about that. We haven't taken their idea and they haven't taken ours. It's just a case of parallel evolution. But our game does it in a different way. So I think we're kind of clear like that. There is a big risk with combining these mechanics for RPG and solitaire, in that maybe the card game players won't be interested because it's got too much RPG stuff. Mm-hmm. Maybe the RPG players won't be interested because it's got cards in it. So, and it's not really a collectible card game. It's not it doesn't use the same kind of mechanics or unwrapping of decks that they do. Mm-hmm. It's got a that sort of feel. So there's a big risk. We may have a failed Venn diagram where mm-hmm. both parts are separate. And that is a risk. But
yes,
Puzzle Quest, you correctly identified, is the closest thing to this game, I guess. Mm-hmm.
And speaking about Puzzle Quest, going back to what we were saying earlier, that is a really good example of a game that it looks very casual, and it could be played casual, but there are elevated takes on it, at least with the older forms. I have the DS version of it somewhere around here. I played the heck out of that. And then,
it's a good game.
Yeah. And then they did the PC one. There's a space version of it. There's a sequel. I know they recently been doing Marvel Puzzle Quest, etc. And again, you, like you were just saying, Jake, you really do run that risk. Again, when you're combining these very distant genres and mechanics from each other. And this goes back to a topic that I talked about a really, really long time ago. I think I made an article about this on Gamasutra, about the two diverging markets between people who prefer action-based games, you know, your Dark Souls, your Ninja mm-hmm. Gaiden, Devil May Cry, and those who prefer the abstraction-based titles, your RPGs, Final Fantasy, etc. And now we have been seeing a blending of those two lately with titles like Borderlands, Skyrim, The Witcher, etc. Mm-hmm. And when we start talking about combining these two, as you correctly pointed out, you do run the risk of alienating those people. You run, like, someone who plays an RPG may not like having all this, you know, very fast-paced combat to deal with. Just like someone who plays an action game may not like, you know, how everything is being held up by grinding and finding gear. And it's going to be interesting to see how Shaohan goes in the market. As you said earlier in the cast, you're really aiming for this to be a quote-unquote Steam game to attract that market.
Hmm. Yeah, we are. Also, I think because card games aren't action-based, you don't need Twitch skills to play them, mm-hmm. and you don't need Twitch skills to play turn-based combat games. So in a way, at least those two things fit together. Imagine we'd added an action component to this game. That would have definitely been a mistake. Mm-hmm. I think this is a cerebral game that you can play fast if you want, or slow if you want to sit down and think about it. And that's fine. So I think at least those things work together. It's just this idea of cards versus RPG. But I still think there must be a significant crossover of people that like RPGs who play Magic the Gathering or something like that. You know, that's the kind of thing. But the whole point of aiming for Steam is just to make sure that the theme is, whether there's combat in there, the theme is kind of interesting, not too casually, and that we've added so much depth. You know, the fighting has got stuff like stun, bleed, poison, you know, damage, defense, haste, you know, boosting all these different abilities. You've even got a resistance to alcohol is one of the things we've got in the game. So we've got a lot of interesting stuff in there. You can drink tea as well to remove the effects of alcohol, which is every British person knows is an appropriate measure. So
cool. And it does sound very fascinating. I guess in terms of the design, as you said a few minutes ago, it's going to be based on that specific type of solitaire play where you can basically make the chains going up and down. In terms of, I guess, how you're pitching the game, this goes back to what we were just saying in terms of making a Steam game. Do you see this as being in like that same kind of casual market as Regency Solitaire? Or do you see it as being aimed more towards like a core or more like advanced kind of play?
Well, we do think it is more towards the core and advanced type of play. Mm-hmm. There was a phrase that used to bounce around a few years ago called mid-core, mm-hmm. somewhere between casual and hardcore. Maybe that's where this fits, because some people might view the card game, the playing of the actual cards, as kind of casual, although there's a surprising amount of depth to that as well. Mm-hmm. And they might view the RPG aspects as more hardcore. So perhaps, you know, this is a blending, which it may or may not work. We don't know. We hope it will work. It's something new. So what we're not doing is we're not relying on the actually, you know, in reality, low popularity of Regency Solitaire on Steam. We're not relying on that to drive customers to this, mm-hmm. because there's not enough customers of Regency Solitaire on Steam to make this game a success. There is in the casual market, but those players aren't on Steam anyway. So we need to reach out and attract a new audience. And one of the key things we've done is just this week we're finalizing the trailer, and the trailer really is quite action-packed and shows a lot of the depth and strategy. And we're hoping that people will see that. I mean, people have commented to me that they're not even into card games and the trailer made them want to play it. Yeah. So that's a really good sign. And if we can follow that up with great reviews both on Steam and off Steam, and YouTubers and streamers playing it, then we stand a chance. And that's all we're doing as game developers is rolling the dice as well. trying to weight them as best we can and then roll them.
I think that's a really good point to elaborate on in terms of the advanced play. Because again, as you just said, Jake, that if someone hears the term solitaire in a game, they're thinking that it's going to be very basic. Again, as we said earlier in this cast, they're sneering at it as being just a quote-unquote another casual game. So my question for you is, what does like the advanced play of Shadowhand look like? How will like these different cards or this different gear really add up to provide that kind of complexity that you're hoping to drive people to?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, as I said, all we've really done is we've made these runs of cards replace, you know, random number generation. So you actually have slightly more control over the RNG in our game than you would if it was just a straight up turn based where you don't know the outcome of the hit you're about to do. So there's a certain strategic element in how you play the cards, and you can use jokers and wildcards to get better runs. How you choose your mini deck of special abilities in order to help clear those cards or convert them into other useful cards to build a higher run. So there's actually quite a lot of strategy just in how you play the cards and so on. But then you've got on top of that the whole layer of what are the best weapons to fight this enemy? If I've looked at their defenses, and also what are they attacking me with? What should I use as defenses? What potion should I take to buff? You know, how can I debuff them by throwing certain bombs at them to basically turn the tables in your favor? So that whole layer on top is kind of standard traditional turn-based RPG stuff that you might find in a roguelike or in Darkest Dungeon, as I've mentioned, or even in, you know, Baldur's Gate or something like that, where you can pause the gameplay and work out your strategy. So that's the extra layer on top. I think that the basic, I use that in a carefully solitaire style gameplay, actually has a surprising amount of depth, which players will figure as they play it for longer. They'll start to work that out. Do I remove this card or that card? Which one could lead to a better option? And there's quite a lot of fun in just that. So we're actually careful to use the phrase solitaire style rather than solitaire, because, for example, the deck only has cards numbered 0 to 9. There are no royals, and there are 6 suits. And we've done that deliberately to aid you in making larger chains, because the chains overcharge your weapons into a critical hit. So all of these decisions have been made. And also the suits aren't standard suits. They look like pistols, swords, and so on. And if you pick the right suit, it would charge up your weapons faster. So there are many things like that adding to the depth.
Interesting. Now, I guess another question for you, Jake. With all like the depth that you're adding to the game, how long does like a typical battle last in Shadowhand?
Well, that is an interesting question, because one of the things I still need to spend a bit more time doing is testing how long. Well, which is most fun, short or long? Because I can tweak them to be quite short and punchy, or kind of longer, grindy affairs. And obviously, there's going to be some kind of sweet spot in the middle. And you don't necessarily want all battles to be the same length anyway. You do want trash mobs to be able to be killed very simply, and larger bosses to take longer. So there's still a bit of testing and balancing to do there. But at the moment, they only take 2-3 minutes or something like that. Sometimes quicker, sometimes longer, depending on your luck and how you strategize. And I think that's about right, because each hand of cards may take, because in between the fights, there are also sort of plain hands of cards that you need to clear with various other mechanics on, and you find loot such as the gear, the bombs, and so on that you can then use in fights. A bit like in an RPG where once you've had a fight, you go off and explore and you find chests and you restock. You know, something like Dark Souls, exploring is key to surviving. So, you know, you've got hands in between and they take maybe 3 to 5 minutes. The point is the whole game has got in the region of 180 hands. So it's a sort of more like a 10-hour experience, but to play through the whole thing.
Okay. Now, one thing that we were talking about earlier with like your other titles and again, like a lot of what we see in casual games, it's having like side systems or side things you can do to either enhance a game or as a way of taking a break. In Plants vs. Zombies, they had like sort of like the Zen Garden mode, and I'm sure there are plenty more examples in the casual market. For Shaohan, are there any like side mechanics or side quest content that the player can do beyond just the RPG-style battles?
Well, as I said, it's actually really a mix of the battles and these hands that you play in between where you gather resources. Mm-hmm. So, and those hands are more like Regency Solitaire or Fairway Solitaire, but they have extra mechanics like keys and locks and things you need to find. Like there's a level where you have to find wanted posters and get rid of them, and another one where you have to find blackmail letters as well. So there are sort of levels tied into the story with other mechanics that almost serve as a break. It's like pacing, you know, you have some jewels and then you have a break and you do this other stuff and then you can get back to the jewels. So we've got that mixture in there. And one more thing I forgot to mention is there is another meta game, which is your character has 6 core stats, a bit like strength, dexterity and so on you'd expect in RPGs. Mm-hmm. But ours are different in that they don't affect fighting, they affect the cards. So they affect how many of them are turned over at the start so you can plan ahead, or how often you find wild cards, or how quickly your special abilities charge and stuff like that. So that's an extra metagame we've layered on top. There aren't any sort of separate modes you can play the game in, but I'll say yet, because I do have a really cool idea, which if this game pans out and sells, I will add. But more on that another time.
All right. And I actually just found the game I was thinking of. It was Runespell Overture.
Oh, I know the one. Yeah, I've played it. Yeah, as research, of course.
Yes. And that one combined poker with like this kind of RPG system.
Yeah.
And again, it's very interesting to see when these games get combined like that. But I'm sure we could spend who knows how long talking about that one. And
I think it was quite well done. I did try it out, but it did have a standard deck of looking cards, and we've tried to make ours much more themed to the whole game and move away from the idea of a card game to the cards are more a metaphor for, as I say, rolling dice or whatever than that. We've tried to combine it all together a bit better.
Yeah, and I think that is a good way to go there with it's not, like as you're saying, this isn't a solitaire game. This is an RPG that makes use of solitaire in a basic form for its content. And there is a big difference between the two.
For sure. And that's why we're leading with sort of RPG card game, and then, you know, we follow up with the idea that it's a solitaire style turn-based combat. Mm-hmm. And then that makes people think, what is that, you know? Yes. So combat solitaire, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And I think with that, we can probably start to wrap things up. Again, we've gone over our hour. I'm sure we can jump on who knows how many more topics tonight, but I don't want to keep you all night long where you are. So I guess we'll begin to wrap things up here. Before we go into my final series of questions for tonight, Jake, are there any other parts of Shaohan in terms of its design that we didn't mention that you would like to bring up now?
Well, that's a good question, and I should have thought ahead. I think, to be honest, we've probably covered most aspects. Mm-hmm. Just to say that there is a sort of visual novel style story throughout the game for players that like that kind of thing. You know, you can skip it, of course, if you want. No, I think we've pretty much covered its various elements. Just that it's been nearly 2 years to make, and we spent a lot of time researching and crafting and making it really fun. There's a lot of different enemies in the game, very interesting ones that you won't see in other standard RPGs. You know, we've got a washerwoman who you fight with with laundry bats. There are people who can throw diseased rats at you. And you can fight people in a marsh and you throw leeches at them, for example. So there are attack dogs. You know, there's a grave digger who whacks you with a spade. Of course, we've got highwaymen and rogues, as you'd expect, and soldiers. We've even got revenue men in there who attack you with weapons almost as painful as paying your tax bill.
Nice. I guess one question I was just thinking about, in terms of, I guess, replayability, do you see Shadowhands being a game that you can play multiple different ways?
I think so. Now, with Regency Solitaire, we had a normal mode and a hard mode. Some people would play it through once and then play it again to challenge themselves to reach these harder goals. Mm-hmm. And we're definitely going to have the same two modes in this game. Mm-hmm. But of course, because there are many different outfits and weapons, you may decide on one run through to sort of use mostly guns and certain types of outfits that benefit those guns, mm-hmm. or and potions accordingly that give you accuracy, for example, and ranged weapon damage. Other times you may decide to be a melee fighter and there's a huge variety of weapons there, mm-hmm. and again tailor your character according to that. You do have only the one character, mm-hmm. but you can change the way they look and what they use and level up your stats in a different way, of course. So I think there's replayability there, plus this extra mode that I've got planned, mm-hmm. will be a very, very replayable mode if I add it. We will see.
Awesome. All right, so I think with that, we'll begin to wrap things up. Again, for those of you listening, there still are a conversation we need to have about being in the independent market or the indie market for so long, but we will have to save that for another time, or that's easily possibly another hour and a half, 2 hours of us sitting here and talking. So to wrap things up for tonight, Jay, I guess just a few basic questions for you regarding Shadowhand and when it's released. So I guess, mm-hmm. the first one is, do you have an estimate for when the game will be out?
You know, my publisher's been asking me this for nearly 2 years, and we keep moving the goalposts because we discover this game has, well, we overscoped this game and we've put a lot more depth in it than we want, mm-hmm. but it's going to be good now. Mm-hmm. We are aiming for April.
Okay.
That's what we're aiming for. So we're pretty close now.
Mm-hmm. And as we've said throughout this cast, it is going to be on Steam. Are you planning on aiming for any other major platforms like GOG, Humble Bundle, or stuff like that?
Yeah, both of those are very likely, mm-hmm. as well as selling direct on my own website or Cliff's website, probably.
Okay. And I guess I'm trying to think if there's anything else I just want to throw in. I think that's about it. Yeah, so I'm definitely interested in looking at the game. I'm always a fan when we see these combinations of unique mechanics and systems together. One of my favorite titles from like back in the day was this game called The World Ends With You for the Nintendo 3DS, which was, mm-hmm. like one of like the craziest RPGs I think I've ever played. And I'm sure we could easily talk about some of our favorite RPGs if we want to spend another hour here.
Sure. Well, one thing I'm happy to do is give you a beta key to try out the game on Steam. Mm-hmm. And we're actually getting the Steam page live just before we head off to GDC. Cool. With the new trailer so that we can start collecting wish lists. So I'm, mm-hmm. going to give you a link to that in due course as well.
Cool. All right, so I think with that, let's wrap things up for tonight. Again, Jake, it has been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for coming on. And like I said, when you get back from GDC and, of course, jet lag and all that is gone, I would love to talk to you either live or with another podcast more on about the business side of being an indie developer.
Yeah, that would be great. And, you know, it's been a pleasure being on the show tonight. Thanks.
Cool. All right, so with that said, we're going to end things here. As always, thank you so much for listening. And if you would like to support Game Wisdom, we have several options available. To write a guest piece for the site or be a future guest on any one of our podcasts, live discussions, whatever, you can get in touch with me through email, josh@game-wisdom.com, or through the Submissions Wanted link on the front page. Be sure to follow me on Twitch and Twitter under or at GWBicer for updates and our daily streams. Check us out on YouTube. The Game Wisdom channel has now gone over 1,300 subscribers as of this recording, and we are continuing to grow with daily videos on video games and game design vlog pieces. Last but not least, you can catch us on Patreon under Game Wisdom or GW Bicer, where you can support us. And as we hit goals, there will be more content for everyone to enjoy. So, again, Jake, thank you so much for coming on, and good luck with Shadowhand. I hope this does well for you.
Thank you very much.
All right. So, once again, for those of you listening, thanks for tuning into this week's Perceptive Podcast. Have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time.